Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Dar Jamayo. He's an award-winning journalist and author who's a full-time staff reporter for truthout.org. His work is currently focusing on anthropogenic climate disruption. So first, as always, Dar, thank you for your amazing work. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Well, thank you, Derek. It's always a real pleasure to be on your show.
So let's talk about the oceans today. How are the oceans doing?
The oceans are not doing well at all, to put it diplomatically. There's numerous extremely loud alarm bells ringing that show us that human impact on the oceans is severe and most likely even already past the point of no return on multiple levels. There's a report that just came out very recently, actually, that I'm writing about right now, that shows that there is a major, major reduction in the amount of dissolved oxygen in the oceans due to climate disruption. And this is because the oceans are absorbing a very, very large amount of the CO2 that we're pumping into the atmospheres. And so this is causing acidification of the oceans itself. But it's also causing a deoxygenation, and this is what we're seeing, and it's now confirmed by a scientific study where the lead author of the study, I want to just read you this quote because it really pretty much sums it up. He said, "Loss of oxygen in the ocean is one of the serious side effects of a warming atmosphere and a major threat to marine life. Since oxygen concentrations in the ocean naturally vary depending on variations in winds and temperature at the surface, it's been challenging to attribute any deoxygenation to climate change, but this new study tells us exactly when we can expect the impact from climate change to overwhelm the natural variability." So to overwhelm the natural variability, I mean, this is a situation where literally the report shows us that our impacts on the oceans are literally making it harder for fish to breathe, as well as exacerbating the effects of ocean acidification. So we're literally starving the oxygens of oceans. So this is I don't think I even need to go into any more detail than that. This is a very, very huge problem. And then, of course, with the acidification, while we're speaking right now, we are looking at probably what is the very end of the Great Barrier Reef in Australia. The Great Barrier Reef is the single largest ecosystem on the planet. It's 1,400 miles long. It's visible from space. It's over 133,000 square miles of area. And it is at least 93% bleached out because of warmer ocean temperatures, which basically means the vast majority of that area that's undergoing this bleaching event is probably not going to recover. And given how high of a percentage of all marine life that spends some part of its life on reefs, this is a major, major issue. And that's why some of the leading coral reef experts around the world are saying acidification is already so progressed that we're likely to not have any coral reefs anywhere on the planet by the year 2050. And that's not very long from now. So those are just a couple of broad brushstrokes to give you an idea of how utterly advanced and worrisome the situation in the oceans is already.
Well, if we leave aside for a moment the effects of industrial civilization in pumping carbon into the air, then certainly, given that the oceans, this is a water planet, and the oceans are the vast majority of life on this planet, that means that governments and corporations and people in general are responding by trying to protect what's left of life in the oceans, correct?
If only you and I know that is, the opposite is what's happening. I mean, despite all these warning signs coming from the scientific community, even people like UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon saying as many as 4 years ago, warning of the over-exploitation of the ocean's fish stocks was such a severe problem. Even he admitted in 2012 that many, many species of fish have already been hunted down to fractions of their original populations. and admitted then that over half of the entire global fisheries are already exhausted, and at least another third of them are classified as depleted. And that was in 2012, so things are much worse now.
Well, if you – in Endgame, which I wrote 2001 to 2005, I cited how the oceans were – basically the fish in the oceans were collapsing. And then I did a little bit of research, and I found that the same sort of articles have been published in like 97, 2003. I think I predicted that they would happen again in 2007 and 2011 or something. My point is not that this is henny-penny, but on the other hand, my point is that it doesn't take a cognitive giant to figure out that if you're vacuuming the oceans, it kills them. And these warnings come out regularly, but they are regularly ignored.
That's right. And so all the average person sees that's not paying very close attention to this is when you go to buy fish in the store, it's either not available or it's way more expensive. And that's these trends are just going to continue. And yes, clearly the alarm bells are being sounded. They have been being sounded now for well over a decade. And again, what's happening, things are only continuing to get worse. And it's the exact same thing when we talk about climate disruption in general. We are at over 400 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere. The last time there was this much CO2 in the atmosphere was 15 million years ago, and the seas were 80 feet higher. This is a bit of an alarm bell. And yet, what are governments doing? Let's grow the economy.
And something that this is a bit off topic from the oceans, but something that has concerned me greatly about this mass extinction compared to previous ones is that as the climate would change quickly in previous mass extinctions, creatures were not in fragmented habitat and they could still at least attempt to flee north or south. And if we go to the oceans, previous mass extinctions, they had to deal with a rapid change of temperature, and many of obviously didn't as they were wiped out. But they didn't also have to deal with both plastics and overfishing. I mean, humans weren't fishing the oceans at the same time, overfishing the oceans at the same time.
That's right. So it's a multiple threat. I mean, you're exactly right. We didn't have the insane amount of plastic, both in bulk as well as in particulate form, in microplastics, for example, that are already being absorbed by plankton itself. The complete total base of the oceanic food chain is now regularly ingesting these microplastics. And we didn't have massive, massive overfishing to where now, conservatively, we can say, well, even according to the UN, 85% of all the global fish stocks are, as they say, already overexploited, depleted, or trying to recover from depletion, 85%. And that's the UN, so we know that that's a conservative figure. But 85%, you know, how we can't get too much more than that. We don't, the point being is there's just not that much left. So really, the oceans are basically under assault on all fronts, whether it's from us changing the chemistry of the water, from us already having changed the content of the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, to massive pollution, to overfishing, to the Fukushimas of the world. I mean, they are absolutely under assault. And the problem with the oceans is, you know, we you and I are reading all these scientific studies and we're acutely aware what's going on, but the average person, you know, it's kind of out of sight, out of mind. I mean, you're not going to see most of this actually happening since, you know, the brunt of it is underwater. And so that's a big problem too. It's not necessarily right up in people's faces. So it's a pretty easy thing to ignore, unfortunately.
You know, I was, this was 8 or 9 years ago. I was, at a restaurant where people, it's sort of family style, where everybody's just sitting at these big tables. And so you sit with people you don't know. And I happened to be sitting next to this guy who I live on the coast, and he said that he used to come over to Crescent City all the time to go fishing just because he enjoys fishing. But he doesn't do it anymore because A, he doesn't want to contribute to the overfishing, but B, really, it was that he can't catch fish anymore. That even in the last 15 years, well, in the previous 15 years, the fish stocks had declined here such that recreational fishing was much more problematical. So he was, so even a person who was attending but was not a, you know, environmentalist as such, he can't really fish anymore.
That's right. And I've heard a lot of stories like that too for individual commercial fishermen or sport fishermen that they're just like, look, it's just not there to catch, or we're having to go out so much further to catch it. And I'm seeing those kinds of reports all over, especially in countries where there isn't like a big well-funded commercial industry like in the West. But if you go off some of these coastal countries in the continent of Africa where, you know, these guys going and these fisher folk going out in their boats, maybe they have an engine, maybe they don't, i.e. they're fairly limited on how far they go. And they're like, look, we're just struggling to make it anymore because we're having to go out so far. So we can't afford the fuel. We can't afford to get out there. We don't have that kind of time. And for a recent article that I wrote about this, I spoke with a biological oceanographer named Dr. Maria Salta, and she's based over in the UK. And she basically said as much that if we continue on like what we're doing with overfishing and other things that we're doing to the oceans that you and I just spoke of, she says, quote, there is not going to be much left. And then another quote that she said that I think was really pretty much cut to the point. She says, we're losing species every day without ever even knowing about them. And sometimes humans can be like a plague to the environment.
As we see. So I read recently, or I read a while ago, I guess, that in if you weighed all the fish in the oceans in 1870 and then you weighed them again in about 2010, in those 140 years, the weight of all the fish in the oceans had been reduced by 90%. And do you, oh, okay, I know one story off the top of my head of how fecund the oceans used to be, and that's there were so many cod in the North Atlantic that ships would actually the schools were so thick that ships would actually their progress would be impeded by the cod. And do you know other stories like that? Can you paint any pictures of what the oceans once were like? Like I know, for example, that when I was a kid, no, this was yeah, this is when I was a very No, this is before I was born. My mom has talked of the Grunion runs in Southern California, even outside of LA, that you'd be out there and you could like put a bucket in a wave and then there would be Grunion fall into the bucket. And so do you know more stories like that of how fecund the oceans used to be? Or can you tell stories from yourself in Alaska or anything?
Well, John Muir, I recently read several of his essays from his trips up to Alaska, and he wrote back then of going up on these steamships and then being based in these areas and going around in canoes with some of the native communities, of literally going past some of these the mouths of some of these rivers while salmon runs were in progress, where there were so many salmon going up the rivers that literally it was foaming the water, and it sounded like a locomotive. That there was a roar of there was so much fish action happening in these rivers every time there was a salmon run that it was even literally challenging even to get nearby the river. And him also describing it from the land, of seeing it from the land, that there were so many fish. He said it's as if you could like walk across their backs across the river to get to the other side, that it was that, you know, that much. And another example is there's the Elwha River here, which was dammed up until fairly recently. It was one of the few successful dam removal projects that ever even happened in this country. And it is a so it's a big success story, albeit it's just one. But one of the native women that was involved in helping taking the actions to get that dam removed, her mother described salmon fishing in the Elwha River before the dam existed and before the overexploitation of the oceans really caught its stride. And they used to measure the salmon by how many steps it took to get from the head to the tail. So she said a good salmon was 3 steps. And look at the size of the salmon today.
So take us forward then through, let's in a while, let's talk about management. But before then, can you talk about some of the technologies for fishing? Like why, how are these, let's leave aside deoxygenation for a moment and talk about some of the technologies for fishing that are so incredibly destructive. How are the fish getting overfished?
Well, the technology, basically the size of the boats and the size of the nets and the use of radar. Basically, the short version, the short answer is the fish just don't have a chance. It's not a sport. There's really it's literally just how can we go get these monstrous multi-mile long nets and so in some cases half a mile to a mile deep nets out and pull them through the water and then just pull out as much fish as we possibly can on an industrial scale. To give you an idea of how much of everything in the oceans they go catch, if they're just looking for one particular type of fish, for fish, for example, 30% of the entire catch in the nets is bycatch, which means it's stuff that's pulled up, it's not what they want, it dies, and then they just throw it back overboard. For shrimpers, for the commercial shrimping industry, 80% of everything that is caught is bycatch and thrown back for dead. So it literally is, from some of the scientists I spoke with in the article I wrote recently, several of them agreed. And then Dr. Salta, who I mentioned, she said, look, this is literally a mode of mass marine extinction. Just talking about bycatch alone, not even talking about the massive amounts of fish that they are been taking out. And that's why we're down to single digit percentile of most of the major commercial fish that are being caught that are even left in the ocean. So we're talking about these ships. And so, for example, I was working on a story about the Navy, what they were doing in some of their extremely destructive exercises up in the Gulf of Alaska last year. And I part of that story had me out at the walking the docks of the fishermen in Kodiak Island, Alaska. And if you look at the size of some of these ships, I mean, these are massive, 60, 80, 90, sometimes 100 foot long vessels. And you look at the winches that they use for these just to put their nets out and pull them back in. And the winches are 10, 12 feet in diameter. So, and then you look at the amount of net that they put out, and it's again, the fish just don't have a chance. And of course, the sophistication of the radars is increasing by the year, where they know exactly where they are, how deep they are, how many there are in a lot of instances, depending on how sophisticated the fishing vessel is. And so, again, it's just, it's mind-boggling when you look at the technology being used just to go catch fish, as well as the scope of how far these boats can go, how fast they can go, and how big the nets are that they're using.
You know, the whole bycatch question. I was in town the other day, and I guess this is my restaurant day because I was at a restaurant, and I overheard one guy talking to another at a different table, and he was a shrimper who he said that he's getting out of the business because he can't do it any longer, not because there aren't shrimp, but because he said he could no longer bear throwing out. I don't remember his exact numbers, but it's like basically what you just said, that he said he couldn't bear killing 4,000 pounds for every 1,000 pounds that he actually see. I mean, he didn't mind killing the shrimp in terms of he's making a living at it, but he said he couldn't bear killing. I think the ratio was what you just said, that, and he said it's like I kill 5,000 pounds for every 1,000 pounds I sell. And he said he couldn't do it anymore. So, I mean, good for him on that, but it's an incredibly, I mean, I'll say wasteful, but that just doesn't encompass it when we're talking about the murder of the oceans.
Well, and to hold up against the commercial industry that I just described of the types of vessels and the technology and how unfair it is to the fish, that they just literally don't have a chance. I mean, by comparison, if we were going to have a way of fishing that was sustainable, it would look like one person going out in a boat with oars, with one fishing line, and catching what you need, catching your one or two fish for you and or your family, and then going back to shore and not eating fish every day, you know, eat maybe once or twice a week. I mean, that's and even that, if everyone, you know, if every one of the 7.3 billion people on the planet was doing that, that wouldn't be sustainable. But hold that model up to what we're looking at today in the commercial fishing industry.
Well, this is something else that's really important. You're raising a hugely important point in that I've got a friend in Spokane who does a lot of work, a couple of friends in Spokane who do a lot of work on salmon and dam removal and generally water issues. And although the dams on the Columbia, you know, are devastating to the salmon, she says that the problem began long before. The problem was canneries. And the point I'm getting at is that there is no population of any – we're seeing this – no population of any creature on the planet can survive infinite global demand.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter how fecund you are. You can be as fecund as the Columbia River salmon. And even before the dams, they were in trouble because of these massive canneries that were shipping salmon all over the world. Look at passenger pigeons. They couldn't survive infinite demand either for their meat.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it is. It's just bottom line is there's far, far, far too many humans on the planet. And that in itself is a massive, if not the single biggest part of the problem. And then, of course, you throw in economics and the commercial fishing industry and how profit's driving everything into overdrive, that it's absolutely unsustainable, to the point where another of the scientists that I spoke with in the recent article on it, he said, look, the entire commercial fishing industry, not might, but will collapse because there's literally just not going to be any more fish to catch. And it's just they're literally, you know, fishing themselves out of existence at the pace and the scale at which they're fishing today.
So how do fisheries managers, like the bureaucrats in charge, how do they? Okay, I think you and I would agree that there has never been a case of management for extraction that has not significantly harmed the species being managed and the entire biome. But how do they talk about how we need to just manage the fisheries better. Can you talk about management a little bit? And what that means, I mean, both what they mean when they say it and what the effects are on the real world.
I'm gonna use that as I'm gonna speak to that, but use it as a way to bring in the article that we just published Monday about the U.S. Navy and the amount of destruction they're allowed to cause in the oceans by their naval exercises. So the NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, within NOAA, there's a thing called NMFS. It's, you'll hear it referred to as NMFS, National Marine Fisheries Services. And so when, for example, the Navy is going to go out and conduct all their military exercises and trainings in the Northern Pacific, in the four main regions of the North Pacific where they do these things, they have to go to NOAA and National Marine Fisheries Services and say, okay, we're going to be doing these bombing trainings and torpedoes and testing certain ordnance, and we're going to be doing all these weaponized sonar testing and using sonobuoys and all of this. So they have to get a permit to do their trainings. And so the National Marine Fisheries Services, which is theoretically there to oversee and limit the destruction that these naval exercises would cause to the fisheries, they have to sign off on what the Navy proposes. And so when the Navy does these exercises, there's, if they're going to either cause a disturbance in the marine life, whether, let's say it's a dolphin, for example, if they conduct an operation and they use a sonar and it disturbs that dolphin, or if it harms that dolphin, or if it kills it, the disturbance, the harm, or the death is called a take. And so their permits, and this is so effed up because they literally are allotted a certain amount of quote-unquote takes of wildlife when they do these exercises. And again, this is coming from NOAA and the National Marine Fisheries Services, who theoretically manage the fisheries, right? That's like why they have the name that they do. And so I did this story where I used the Navy's own documents and the documents from the National Marine Fisheries Services and from NOAA of what they used to give the Navy the permit. And over the next 5 years, in just the Northern Pacific alone, in all the Navy's exercises, they are permitted to kill or injure nearly 12 million whales, dolphins, and other marine mammals in just the Northern Pacific.
That doesn't include fish.
That does not include fish. We are only talking about mammals, large marine mammals, seals, sea lions, dolphins, and whales. Nearly 12 million. That's a high enough number, Derek, that they're going to have to hit a lot of the species more than one time, a lot of the same animals more than one time. That's how high that number is.
I was going to say, are there even 12 million large marine mammals in that region?
Right. No, there's not. If every one of those so-called takes is on the death end of the spectrum, there will be no more.
This reminds me of the management of the Colorado River, where more than 110% of the river is allocated to be taken out.
Right.
Not just 100%, but more than 110%.
Right. And I think, you know, the statistic I just gave about the takes and what you just said about the river, this is how it's quote unquote managed, where, you know, when it comes to, if it's the military doing whatever the military wants to do, or if it comes to corporate power making more and more money, damn the consequences to the environment, we know what the so-called managing agencies are going to do. I mean, yes, here's my rubber stamp. Where do you want me to put it? And I'll wait your next paperwork, your next permit that you apply for.
Oh, that reminds me that I don't know if you knew about this. Oh, yeah, of course you did. I think I actually read this in your work. Sorry. That with the Deepwater Horizon environmental impact statement, there were comments that in the documents they used to justify building the Deepwater Horizon, they said that it would not harm walruses. And my point is that they just took the same documents that they used on the in up in the Arctic and used them for the Gulf of Mexico and didn't even bother to switch out the sea mammal.
That's exactly right. Yeah, they took literally the same paperwork from the disaster preparedness that arose in the wake of the Exxon Valdez in 1989, and just said, "Oh yeah, we'll just use this in the Gulf." They didn't even care enough to look to, like, you know, erase the walrus part from their own paperwork.
So how does the concept of management retain any of quote scientific management retain any credibility given the obvious truths of what you're saying?
Well, it can't. I mean, there's no government agency, and I would even argue on a state level, I have yet to see any evidence federally or on a state level of any kind of a management service that actually manages, well, I'm using their terms, which I hate, but
right,
to manage a quote unquote resource. There's nothing out there that is working in the best interests of these so-called resources, i.e. life on the planet, that is going to give them a fair shake. Because in reality, I mean, look at everything that we're talking about, that the normal sane response would be, look, okay, we're basically down to single digit fish left in the seas as far as percentile compared to what we should have if it's a healthy ecosystem. One would think if we're down to below 10%, we need to stop all fishing completely and we need to let it rebuild. We need to start mitigating the destruction, the pollutants, the plastic that's already in there. We need to do full stop and go into reverse with as much mitigation as immediately as is even feasible. And instead, we see the opposite. It's full steam ahead, pedal to the metal, we're off the cliff. How can we accelerate this further? You know, I mean, it's just, it's night and day. Just, you know, the insanity of it is clear, that there is no management. There's none happening. And if there was such a thing as management, I would argue confidently that it would look like, okay, full stop to the entire commercial fishing industry. And we need to first start doing what we can to try to rehabilitate the destruction that we've caused to the oceans.
You know, this is a fantasy that I've had for 20 years, which I fully recognize is a completely unrealistic fantasy, which is that we were to use, you know, we consider ourselves, incorrectly, I think, the most clever or intelligent species on the planet. And if we actually were the most clever or intelligent, and if we were to use that and to use our engineering ability, which is actually quite dramatic, to actually try to repair the damage that's been done, I would think, if that were the case, I would still have stayed in science and still be an engineer, you know? Mm-hmm. That would be really fun, I think, to be doing everything we can to try to help the tuna or the cod or the starfish or whomever. That would actually be a very enjoyable use of our problem-solving ability.
Well, it's not, and that's what's really maddening about the whole situation. I mean, and if we look at it just from a climate disruption perspective and just the imperativeness of, we need to be having the same type of response to climate disruption as if, to use one of your analogies from your work, Derek, as if like we're being attacked by space aliens, you know, one of those bad sci-fi novels where, okay, all the global governments see, you know, literally the entire species is at risk and we need to band together to try to figure out how we're going to stop this from happening. That's the type of response we need to be having to climate disruption. And by way of example, to give you an idea of, you know, how insane the non-response really is, it would take 10%. Okay, the Pentagon's budget for 2015 was around $600 billion. That's the known budget. That doesn't include the black sites and the black programs, et cetera, which kicks it up to over a trillion. But let's go with what they admit, $600 billion. 10% of that. It would take 10% of that, $60 billion, to completely outfit the entire country's infrastructure on renewable energy, including the transportation sector. That's it. That's all it would take. And I'm not talking about that's going to solve the problem or anything at all. But I mean, just to talk about, okay, if we're going to get serious about getting off of fossil fuels, that's how little it would actually take. But that's where our priorities are. And we all know the rest of this story of who's running government and, you know, what the centers of power really are, and et cetera. But point being is, we have the knowledge, we have the intelligence, we have the funding. We're just so off track of, instead of really trying to live in a very proper, moral, ethical way on the planet, that, you know, instead we're here on the fringes of this, you and I at least, on the fringes of this system that's hell-bent on destroying everything that's left on the planet. And that's becoming a taller and taller order because there's fewer and fewer things. I mean, there's a report that came out even just 2 days ago that showed literally one third of the entire North American bird population will go extinct, save soon, like within this century, save, you know, dramatic mitigation efforts of the level that, you know, we've kind of alluded to. I mean, we're watching species disappear before our eyes. And like I said earlier, the other crisis in the oceans is there's so many species that are going extinct that we never even knew existed in the first place. And that's just how fast it's happening.
You know, I've often thought that if you talked to someone 10,000 years ago and you laid out the accomplishments of the dominant culture, that, you know, they put a man on the moon and they bombed the moon and they created computers and interstate highway systems and supersonic jets, and you laid out all the accomplishments, I think the most unbelievable, and for a person 10,000 years ago, the most unbelievable and impressive achievement of the dominant culture would be that they've effectively murdered the oceans. I think that when you think about it, I mean, oceans are what, 2/3 to 3/4 of the space on the of the land, of the surface of the world.
That's right.
And I don't know the numbers, you might, on what percentage of biomass is in the ocean. It's got to be, it's more than half, got to be way more than half. It's, and they have been able to use the word of a manager, which is just sort of disgustingly or delightfully understated, reorganized the ocean. That's what they call it. But I would call it murdered. I mean, the fact that they've been able to, if you took somebody 10,000, if you took somebody, if you took John Muir, and he was, he recognized how destructive this culture is, if you took him and plopped him from that boat that stops at the mouth of a river, and took him to today and said how hard the oceans have been hit, I don't know if he would be able to believe it.
Well, it would seem almost impossible because you look at how absolutely vast the oceans are. I mean, you know, and they're so big that literally 1/4 of the planet's biodiversity is in danger of extinction due only to commercial fishing in just the next 25 years alone. 1/4 of the entire planet's biodiversity is on track for going extinct only because of commercial fishing. And that's because, you know, the normal human response when we overfish certain species is to just go down to the next smaller species of fish. And so it goes on down into, you know, extinction is the final role of that. And one thing, another part of the equation that I know that you mentioned it before when we were talking about this interview and what we're going to cover is trawling. You know, and that's another huge, huge issue here, which is trawling is a way of fishing that basically drags a giant heavy fishing net through the water behind a boat, and drags the net also across the seafloor. And it's basically the equivalent of clear cutting a forest, but you're doing it in the ocean. So you're destroying coral reefs, you're just taking up everything that's on the bottom, literally just clear cutting the ocean. And so that's another reason that biomass of the mid and deeper oceans in the deep sea is in sharp decline, and that's only just because of trawling. So it's again, it's just being hit on all levels. It's like shock and awe of the oceans.
And I mean, I completely agree with you that the only sustainable fishing is, you know, one community only eating the fish that the ocean and the rivers, you know, gladly provide over centuries. You know, the Talua lived where I live now, and they lived here for 12,000 years, and they ate salmon a lot, but they did so with a They didn't. There were as many salmon when the Europeans arrived as there had been when the Talua got here. And they didn't sell the salmon. That's the thing. They ate them. So I recognize. I completely agree with that. But within the current rubric, within the current structure of management, what percentage of this of the commercial fishing harvest? Oh, I want to mention one more thing before I get there, which is also I remember reading a few years ago that the world's commercial fishing fleets are subsidized to a value greater than the value of the catch, which means that taxpayers around the world are actually paying these commercial fishers to go out and kill the oceans. And we would all be better off if they just didn't hand them the money, and instead they handed them the money to stay home in their underpants and watch The Price is Right, you know? So actually, it's not even a money-making proposition. So that's one thing. And if you want to comment on that, you can. But the other thing I wanted to mention, or I wanted to ask, is so what percentage of this of the commercial fishing around the world in the oceans is illegal?
The most recent statistic that I saw is 20%. So that's not being included. All the statistics that we just talked about of bycatch and species going away and et cetera, that's not factoring in 20% of basically black market commercial fishing that's, you know, not on the books, that's not being overseen, not being quote unquote managed. So 20%. So you can add another fifth basically to a lot of the numbers that we just talked about.
And it seems to me that even though the oceans are big, that would be, if we're going to rationalize having a huge military that costs, 600 billion a year. I mean, the least they could do is stop, is act, you know, they call themselves policemen of the world. Least they could do is actually act like regular policemen and enforce some fishing regulations.
Right. And, you know, they, that might happen in, you know, the odd instance here and there. Clearly, it's not going to happen within U.S. waters where you've got, you know, the quote unquote management system in place that we spoke to earlier. But, you know, and instead of that, instead of actually policing the oceans and taking care of them, you have the Navy doing things like what I just mentioned. And that's just, bear in mind, that's only in exercises in the Northern Pacific over the next 5 years. That doesn't include the Central or Southern Pacific. And we're not talking about the Atlantic or anywhere else that the U.S. Navy is operational, which is P.S. every ocean on the planet. So that's just in one little area. So they, you know, it is almost as though their goal is to go out. And that's what I got writing that story about the Navy being officially federally permitted to generate nearly 12 million takes, i.e. injuries and deaths of marine mammals in just the Northern Pacific alone. It's almost as though they're trying to go out and have a negative impact on every single living thing in the oceans. That's kind of the feeling that I got writing that story and then looking at the staggeringly high numbers in the types of species that they're being, that they're allowed to do that with. The North Pacific right whale, endangered species. The humpback whale, endangered species. The blue whale, endangered species. The fin whale, endangered species. The gray whale, endangered species. I mean, we can go on down, and I have this list in the article, and more than half of the things I list are endangered species, and that's all in the Navy's so-called environmental impact statement that has been rubber stamped by the federal government. So that's, and that's the, you know, the so-called Navy, you know, the U.S. policing of the seas. It's as though they can't deleteriously impact these endangered species fast enough or on broad enough of a scale.
Well, this is something that, as you know, is just central to all of my work, is that the only way that I can understand the destruction we see around us, I mean, even capitalism doesn't explain it to me. It's, you know, it's not merely, these aren't, it's not just greed. It's, if it were just greed, then there wouldn't be these, they wouldn't subsidize the commercial fishing fleets to a value greater than their catch. There would still be some rationality within the system and reasonableness. The only way I can understand all of this destruction we see around us is to invoke what you just talked about, the death urge, which I don't think is species-wide, and I don't think it's life-wide. I think it's this culture-wide, and we don't need to get into the reasons for it, but I'm just agreeing with you that that's the only way I can understand the relentless and insatiable and mind-bogglingly stupid destruction that we see around us. I mean, for God's sake, you mentioned the Great Barrier Reefs. You know, at the same time that they're getting hammered with all this other stuff, Australia, last I heard, was planning on dumping coal waste on them.
Right, and dredging for ports for the mines and letting that mine run off to go into the reef, which, of course, there's ample scientific studies to show that when you do that, it wipes out reefs, no matter where you do it, whether it's there or anywhere else in the world. So, yeah, it is. It really is. And I think that is something that I think all of us need to get our heads around about this culture, that the death urge is very, very real, because it is the only thing that explains it, because what's happening, it defies all logic. I mean, it defies common sense. It defies reason. It defies virtually every scientific study that's out there that, you know, teaches us anything about aquatic life and how fragile ecosystems are and how easy it is to impact them. It really is. And the oceans are where this really couldn't be more dramatically apparent.
So we have like 5 or 6 minutes left, and I guess the first question is, given the magnitude of what we face, and given the momentum of this culture, and given that, and given what is at stake, which is life on the planet, and given that I understand, yeah, we have to be nice to each other, and I understand all that, but that's not good enough for me. And because we are talking about life on the planet, what do we do to stop this? To stop this death urge culture that is killing the oceans on this water planet.
I know that I find what I can do. And for me, it's, I feel like I'm a scout, and I do with my writing much like what you do, is I see what's out there, I see what's happening, I write it up, I get it out to our readers, and that's my job. That's what I do. Simultaneously, I go around and give public talks up here about what the Navy's doing to the region right where I live, because I just happen to be living literally right in the middle of Navy headquarters USA, practically, with the amount of infrastructure they have up here in the Pacific Northwest where I live. And so I'm doing everything I can to get information out while simultaneously minimizing my own footprint, not just from a carbon perspective, but a food perspective and a travel perspective, et cetera, and starting to live as close to the land as I possibly can. And that includes growing my own food and living very, very simply and continuing along those trends. And that's what I do personally. I think that each person, we are at a point where I think each person needs to look very, very seriously at our lives and say, okay, realistically, if there's still humans on the planet, the trajectory we're on, if there's still humans on the planet by 2100, it's going to be a minor miracle. And so what's really important to me? And do I really care about this planet? Do I really care about other species on the planet? And if so, what am I going to do about it? Because I think we each need to be asking ourselves those questions on a regular basis, no matter how deeply involved in working to protect what's left we are or not. But I think those are the types of questions we need to ask ourselves, because we're not at a point where we're going to turn the machine around or we're going to save the day or anything like that, like a lot of celebrity journalists will lead people to believe. I think we're more in a situation of brace for impact, but I think we're still in a situation where, at least here in the West, with the privileges that we have in this country, where we can still do some things that might prolong the lives of a few more species or maybe even save a few species. And I think we're morally obliged to do that.
Well, there's a couple things. One of them is that I do know one piece of good news in the oceans, and there are, as you know, more than 450 dead zones in the ocean, and one of them has recovered. Do you know about this?
I don't.
One dead zone recovered, and do you know why? Because it's in the Black Sea, and the Soviet Union collapsed, and it made it so. Agriculture was no longer economically feasible in the region, so they stopped using fertilizers, and so the runoff stopped, and it only took about 25 years for that area to recover. And my point is that if we take this notion of space aliens coming down, we would know what we had to do if they were space aliens who were killing the ocean. Which is, we need to destroy empire, among everything else. So, two things. One, any comments on that?
Yeah, I think this goes back to the question of, how would we properly manage, so-called manage the oceans? It's the same response. First of all, stop destroying it. How about that? That's a novel idea. Stop polluting it, stop overfishing it, stop killing everything in it, zapping it with sonar and other types of weapons, and dumping all of our human-generated waste into it. Let's stop that, because that's exactly what we would do if space aliens showed up and said, okay, we're going to wipe out the oceans because that's where all these people came from. And if we take out the oceans, we're going to take them out. It's where most of their oxygen comes from, et cetera. Well, we would stop that from happening by any means necessary.
And then the last thing, if you don't mind, one of the reasons that you are and have been for so long one of my heroes is the story of how you got activated. Can you tell that story like in a minute? Because the big distinction is not between those who believe we need to bring everything down and those who don't. The big distinction is between those who do something and those who do nothing. And I love the story of how you were in Alaska and you saw something wrong. You know the story, so can you tell that?
The nutshell version of it is I was living in Alaska working on Denali as a mountain guide, and I saw the lies leading up to the Iraq war. I became completely outraged at the complicity of the corporate media in this empire project. I got a laptop and a camera, and I figured out how to get into Baghdad to write about how this was going to impact the Iraqi people, because that's what was not going to be covered in the corporate press. And so that's what I did. And that's basically how I became a journalist. And I was just completely outraged, and I felt passionately about it enough to put my body on the line. And that's why I decided to go do it.
So basically, instead of just, or in addition to just complaining about it and making a post on Facebook about how pissed you are, you saw a problem and you went to fix it.
Right. And that's the only way anything's going to change. And you know, and it did help. It brought some assistance in some ways to some people personally over there that I met and know and still keep in touch with. And that's it. You know, and we have to get out and do things. We have to get out and until we're all out there taking actions, thinking anything's going to change is just a daydream.
Well, that's why you're one of my heroes. So thank you so much. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Dar Jamail. This is Derek Jensen from Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.